Chapter 22, Life at Pleasant View. When Christian scientists come to Pleasant View, I demand of them that they leave their belongings and take up the cross. Mary Baker Eddy. 1905. On the 9th of February, Mrs. Eddy contributed a short article entitled, quote, Heaven, end quote. Miscellany, page 267, to the New York American, in response to an invitation received from that publication. In a notebook she kept, she wrote on the same date, quote, Mrs. Sybil O'Brien of the Boston Herald sought me to contribute to a symposium in that paper, end quote. She acquiesced to this request, also with, quote, Prevention and Cure of Divorce, end quote. Miscellany, page 268, which appeared in the Boston Herald on Sunday, March 5th. First, she poses the question. The frequency of divorce shows that the imperative nature of the marriage relation is losing ground. Hence, that some fundamental error is engrafted on it. What is this error? Her answer, quote, Christ's plan of salvation from divorce, end quote, will stand for all time and leads unto life eternal. But while the woman was teaching and demonstrating eternal life, the mental murderers were again striking at her human sense of life, with a recent report sent through the press that Mrs. Eddy had died of pneumonia 3 or 4 months ago. After keeping the story alive for quite some time, the New York Herald sent a reporter to Concord to see Mrs. Eddy personally. For one who readily gave $1,000 rather than 1 minute of her time, this was a trying demand. It was probably William B. Johnson who answered the door when the man from the Herald arrived. In the reporter's words, in a few minutes the door opened, and an elderly man in clerical garb bade me enter. I entered the vestibule and then the hallway. It was bright and withal homelike and comfortable in its oaken finishings. I was ushered into the cosily but not extravagantly furnished parlor at the right. My host invited me to be seated, and drawing up a chair, faced me. He did not say so, but I knew he wanted to know about my mission. No, I was not speaking with Mr. Fry. I asked his name, but it was not given me. As the two men sat talking, another man entered. It was Mr. Fry, a very pleasant-faced man, with hair slightly tinged with gray and with a short gray mustache, delightful of manners, easy and graceful. Mr. Fry had a bright, smiling face. He greeted me cheerily and said that he had read my letter to Mrs. Eddy and that she would see me in her library for a few minutes. Following this brief interview, Mrs. Eddy wrote to the editor of the New York Herald on that Saturday. A representative of the Herald called today to inform me of the rumor that I had deceased some 3 months ago. This is an oft-repeated falsehood. I granted him a moment's interview, hoping you would refute this rumor in the next edition of your paper. I am in my usual good health, drive out every day, and attend to my regular business. The reporter's story appeared in the New York Herald of Sunday, March 5th. He said of Mrs. Eddy, as Mrs. Eddy spoke, Her face lighted sweetly, a motherly expression, and the brightness of the large, full eyes bespoke the owner's mental activity. Her tall figure was exquisitely gowned in black silk, of becoming modish cut. Her welcome was cordial, but withal I could not but feel the exigencies of my quest for facts had not been without their exactions in thus compelling Mrs. Eddy to stand before me to prove that she still lived. But her grace and charm softened the difficulty and hardship of that visit, and I left Pleasant View with a mind filled with peculiar thoughts. Mrs. Eddy still lives, and apparently is enjoying the normal health of one of her years. The leader wrote Mr. Farlow that the article would help to refute the rumor, but a few days later she wrote him again to, quote, please say and do no more on this silly subject of my decease, end quote. But there were times when the world's hatred, constantly endeavoring to destroy her, seemed almost overwhelming. It took more than faith to sustain her and enable her to face the wicked lies and malice in the storm she sensed was coming. She did not see a glad pathway ahead in the poem she wrote on March 16th. Whither? Father, didst not thou the dark wave treading, lift from despair the struggler with the sea? And heed'st thou not the scalding tear man's shedding? And knowest thou not the pathway glad and free? The weight of anguish which they blindly bind on earth, the bitter searing to the core of love, this crushing out of health and peace, mankind, thou all, thou infinite, dost doom above. Oft mortal sense is darkened unto death, the stygian'd shadow of a world of glee, the old foundations of an early faith, sunk from beneath man, whither shall he flee? To love divine, whose kindling mighty rays brighten the horoscope of crumbling creeds. Dawn, truth delightful, crowned with endless days, and science ripe in prayer, in word and deeds. Love divine uplifted her beyond reach of the enemy's fire, and she in turn was uplifting her children with the same divine love. On March 10th, she wrote to Calvin Hill in appreciation, you are more than a hill, you are a mountain, and the dwelling place of tenderness, unselfishness, soul. The silver dish you sent me is very convenient to keep my lunch warm. Will you let me pay for it? I feel badly to have you expend your money for me. It is all I need, and just what I do need, to have you care for my needs, just as you are doing. God bless you, dear one. Fill you with victory over the falsities of human thought, and with sweet peace and rest from all fear. Love casts out fear. On March 15th, she said in a helpful letter to Laura Lathrop, the body and you are not one. You are not in the body, talking to it, and it cannot talk of itself. You are spiritual, not material. You are my good, faithful follower of Christ, the image of God. Indeed, you are this idea, and have no strife with the flesh. You reflect God, and his image is like unto spirit, not matter. The flesh has no connection with you. Realize this, and you are master of the situation. And to her Augusta, she wrote, "My precious student, yes, you are conscious of God's care and love, and that I will stand by you, will warn and comfort you, and help you onward and upward. Be patient, humble, loving, full of faith and good works, and all will be well with thee." Augusta did not yet know how straight and narrow and singular the path onward and upward is. But the leader knew and was constantly guiding and leading this student to be separate, as her closing paragraph shows. "Be of good cheer, darling. You are supported by a strong arm. Your students are loyal. Now take my advice. Do not counteract any movement for churches or for the unity of two in one, even if it seems best to do so. But let the students learn from experience, and God direct them. You are entrenched and had better be left out than mixed with what cannot mix. So be wise and wait on God, and He will direct thy path." Later in March, she wrote to Augusta again, "Darling, my darling Augusta, do not name a season dress for me now. I am submerged in work for the field and cannot attend to being fitted now. I am going to send you a little remembrance of me as soon as I can attend to it." The leader was submerged in work for the field, and she was also very busy at home. George Kinter had returned to his home fairly early in the year. William B. Johnson returned to his home in Boston on March 16th, the day that Gilbert Carpenter came to Pleasant View to spend a year. Mr. Carpenter made a decision when he embarked upon this year of service to the leader. That was the decision not to take the time to treat himself while he was in her employ. He reasoned that if he did, error might keep him constantly employed in maintaining his own physical well-being, to the neglect of his work for the leader and the cause. He saw himself as, quote, "a channel through which the unbroken power of infinite good flows out to the universe," end quote. And only when thought turns to self is there an interruption of this power, producing illness, stagnation, inflammation, etc. He tested this unfoldment the first time he was tempted with illness. "I sat down by the window and let my thought go out in prayer to all the sufferers in the world, in hospitals, in sick rooms, those condemned under the classification incurable, those without knowledge of the presence of God to care for them, to bring them the truth that there is no incurable disease, and that even though they did not know it, they do have a Heavenly Father, who is the great physician, who, quote, healeth all thy diseases," end quote. I let my thought issue forth to all who needed God with the true realization of the God that is all presence, all power, and love. When I returned from this mental journey, I found myself well. During the year I was at Pleasant View, this divine mode of effort, which I believe was God-inspired, never failed me. Mrs. Eddy was an enigma to most of her students much of the time. But Mr. Carpenter spent the ensuing 50 years endeavoring to understand the baffling experiences that others chose to ignore, bury out of sight, or whisper about behind closed doors. The record of his soliloquies and probings has given us a picture of life at Pleasant View. One of the first things the leader asked each newcomer to her home was, "Do you want to go to church?" If the answer was yes, she explained that it was a mistake for a mature student, such as those in her home, to think they could get something from going to church. Their work was so much broader, on such an advanced spiritual plane, and under her guidance, so much more vital in spreading the gospel of truth, that the desire to attend church was a return to old theology. She impressed upon them that it was their business to uphold the church, not vice versa. One dear teacher has said, quote, "If you go to church, be sure to take it with you," end quote. The days at Pleasant View did not vary. Sunday was no different from any other day. The main work was the mental work, which Mrs. Eddy termed watches, in which everyone participated, including the leader. There were three regular daily watches of 1 hour each, which in 1905 were the morning watch hour from 9 to 10 a.m., the afternoon watch hour from 3 to 4 p.m., and the evening watch from 8 to 9 p.m. Each mental worker had an additional watch of his own, in which he worked alone for an hour. There were times when all worked uninterruptedly to meet some exigency, but this was the exception, and the foregoing was the general routine. Mr. Carpenter has outlined a typical day at Pleasant View in 1905 from a secretary's point of view. Breakfast was at 7:30. The assistant secretary sorted the morning mail, separating all that the secretaries could answer from that needing the leader's attention. They learned to assume responsibility and not to usurp her valuable time for needless details. When they needed help, Mr. Fry made final decisions. Either Mr. Fry or Mrs. Eddy wrote out instructions for the morning watch at 9 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, work on the mail continued, and at 10:45, that which had been set aside for Mrs. Eddy's attention was taken to her. Dinner was at noon, and Mrs. Eddy's was taken to her in her study, although she came downstairs for most of the other meals. Her daily drive was usually at 1 p.m., and at least an hour long. This was a busy hour for all the household, for they endeavored to clean all the rooms, particularly Mrs. Eddy's, and have all in readiness when she returned. She usually rested for half an hour after her drive, then spent the afternoon first with the watch hour, then reading, answering, or dictating answers to letters. Supper was at 6, following which she occasionally called the students for a period of quiet conversation. More often, she called only one student to attend to some business at hand. At times, she might dictate an article. At one time, she dictated some of her early history to Mr. Carpenter. The evening watch hour for all the household was from 8 till 9 p.m. Mr. Carpenter's additional watch was from 11 p.m. till midnight. At the evening watch, Mrs. Eddy went out on the porch and sat in the swing, as Mr. Carpenter has recorded. Every night she sat on the upper porch in her swing from 8 until 9, at which time she retired. Just before leaving for her room, she might call me to come to her swing to say good night. I always felt that she devoted this hour to a general outpouring of spiritual good to humanity, because the sweetness of her thought stood out so vividly when she said good night that it never failed to bring tears to my eyes. It seemed more than I could stand. A peace, a love, a strength and calm emanated from her thought to such a degree that human sense could hardly endure it. Another student who received training in the divinity course at this time was a well-known lecturer. Dr. Fluno was a member of Mrs. Eddy's household during part of the year that Mr. Carpenter was there. Dr. Francis J. Fluno, CSD. Francis J. Fluno, MD, was a practicing physician when he first heard of Christian Science in the summer of 1885. In November of that year, both he and his wife were members of Mrs. Eddy's primary class in the college. Almost immediately, Dr. Fluno entered upon the practice of Christian Science in Lexington, Kentucky. In February of 1887, Dr. Fluno again attended the Metaphysical College, this time as a member of Mrs. Eddy's normal class, which convened February 7th. The following year, 1888, the Flunos moved to San Francisco, locating permanently in Oakland, California, in 1889. Soon after the formation of the Board of Lectureship, in 1898, Dr. Fluno was appointed to that board, lecturing first in the far western United States and later throughout much of the world. The first lecture in Hawaii and the first in Africa were both given by Dr. Fluno. No doubt, being a member of Mrs. Eddy's household strengthened him in his work. He was not a young man at this time, and young Gilbert Carpenter was impressed by the doctor's words. Mr. Carpenter recorded, "An interesting incident I recall is that when he was 70 years old, he sent Mrs. Eddy 3 lectures for her approval. She turned down one of them, declaring that the public was not ready for it. She said that he might give it in 20 years. The question assailed him as to whether he would be lecturing when he was 90 years old, but he did not doubt. He gave the lecture as Mrs. Eddy directed him. It was called, quote, Christian Science, Pure Metaphysics, end quote, and was printed in pamphlet form in 1917. In 1905, at Pleasant View, when Mr. Carpenter had been there only about 3 weeks, he got a lesson in the divinity course, which was quite a surprise to him. Mrs. Eddy called him and asked him to work for her. At the time, he did not know that all the mental workers who were newcomers to Pleasant View got the same assignment after they had been there about 3 weeks. After 30 years of pondering, he wrote, "The main value of the effort to help our leader would have been lost had there been the slightest suggestion that she was asking for such help for any other reason than that she needed it. But after 30 years of pondering the problem, I am reaching the conclusion that perhaps she did not need the help, but requested it for the sake of the growth of the student who was to give it. There is no doubt that the world's resistance to and hatred of the highest manifestation of womanhood ever to appear on this planet caused the woman a great deal of physical suffering, which she was endeavoring to train students to meet and overcome. But the training went on in the divinity course in her home, whether she was experiencing physical suffering or not. After 30 years of pondering and probing, Mr. Carpenter began to suspect that this was the case. At times, she would call me in the middle of the night to come to her to help her audibly. Yet I think she was far more interested in determining my mental status and in training me than she was in receiving such help. One reason for this conclusion is the fact that she listened carefully to every scientific argument I used and was alert to correct me for the slightest deviation, all of which was unlike a person in such great need that they could not help themselves metaphysically. As I argued, she followed me, ready to correct me if I made one misstatement. No matter how badly off she seemed to be, her thought was alert and ready to detect one false declaration. Many of the mental workers who went through this training program in the leader's home believed that their work for her was the important thing, and they well knew each time they were called whether it was a success or a failure, for she told them. Little did they know what the leader was doing for them and for the world. They went back to the field far better prepared to meet the malicious animal magnetism that would attempt to drown the cause of Christian Science. And many of them thought and said that they were never taught the divinity course.